Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the challenges of making personalized medicine that can also be used more broadly.
And a conversation with the editors of a new print magazine that wants to redefine psychedelic art.
But first, state lawmakers who live in Maricopa County would get a pay increase under a proposal up for debate in a House committee later today. The proposal would increase the per diem those legislators get to around $200 a day. Right now, that number is $35 per day. With me now, as he is every Monday during the legislative session, to talk about what to expect this week at the state capitol is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Good morning, Howie.
Good morning. I am exploring a third term in this office, I'd like you to know.
You've been there for well more than three terms, let's be honest
yes.
about that. So I want to start with sort of where we are in the legislative session, because a lot of committee work is generally done. We're now at the point where bills are coming up for debate and votes in each chamber and sort of moving back and forth, right?
Yes, this in some ways becomes where the rubber meets the road. I mean, it's I won't say it's easy to get a bill through committee. But there are a lot of times, and you've been out at the Capitol, and you've also seen this, where they say, well, it's not perfect, I wouldn't like it, but I'll tell you what, we will advance it to the floor and see if you can fix it or convince me that I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're at that stage now. There are so many things where people come up with ideas on how we're going to fix elections, how we're going to change the correction system, how we're going to regulate food stamp purchases. And now you have to figure out, what does it take to get 16 votes in the Senate, 31 votes in the House, and then, assuming you can survive that, get the signature of the governor?
Right. All right. So, Howie, let's talk about this proposal from Representative David Livingston, chair of the House Appropriations Committee, that would increase the amount of per diem in-county lawmakers get, and seemingly by quite a bit.
Well, this is a fascinating issue because if you look at it strictly, per diem is an allowance by definition. So, for example, the lawmakers from outside of Maricopa County get a figure that is equal to what the General Accounting Office, the Federal General Accounting Office, says people should get when they're traveling. If you're coming in from Flagstaff, if you're coming up from Tucson, if you're not driving up every day, you need a hotel here or some sort of alternate place to live, you know, buy or rent a condo. You need the meals, the things that you're normally able to get at home. Lawmakers from in the county don't have those same expenses. I don't get money to drive to the office. I'm guessing you're not getting a per diem from KJZZ from coming down to the office
I'm
there.
Not.
So the question becomes, why raise the per diem? And what Representative Livingston says is, look, Howie, this is not really per diem. It's really part of our salary, even though we acknowledge that it's something different. You cannot raise legislative salary except by voter approval. And the last time voters agreed to do that was in 1998 when they brought it to current $24,000 a year. In fact, there is a measure that's also going to be heard today to ask voters to increase that by inflation backdated
right.
to 1998, which would take us up to about $48,000. Again, that needs to go to the voters. This one does not. This one simply says, well, our expenses are such that we need what's going to be equivalent to, as you point out, about $200 a day. And, you know, to his credit, Mr. Livingston is not saying we need that for expenses. He's saying everyone should be paid roughly equally, and it's unfair to the in-county lawmakers because they have to live on the $24,000 a year plus the $35 a day. Now, also remember, though, that $35 a day is 7 days a week while they're in session, whether, in fact, they are here. That includes Saturdays and Sundays and holidays and everything else. This is going to be something that's popular, I think, with certain in-county lawmakers from both parties. I think there's a feeling, for example, from the resignation of Senator Eva Birch, that the pay is not enough. You know, mm-hmm. She resigned. She said, I cannot keep up my job as a nurse practitioner and come down here and do this for $24,000 a year. But I think the question for a lot of people is it sort of sneaky to do it if you can't get us to approve it at the ballot to do it for yourselves and call it an allowance.
Yeah, that is really interesting. Howie, I want to ask you about a non-legislative, but more of an election-related thing. You mentioned talking about changing the election system. Somebody who's been very involved in that at the state capitol is Scottsdale Representative Alexander Culloden, who later this morning is going to be announcing that he is running for Secretary of State.
Yes, they're trying to create a dream ticket, at least from the perspective of the Freedom Caucus, of conservatives who they think can sway the voters and say, you know, after a couple of years of Katie and Adrian and Chris Mays to come up with a ticket that they think the voters would like more. Now, remember, the last dream ticket was Carrie Lake and Mark Fincham and Abe Hamada, and they didn't go anywhere, so I don't know how well it worked. This ticket would start off with Andy Biggs, who was running for governor, assuming he survives the primary, and then, as you point out, Alexander Culloden for Secretary of State, and then we have Warren Peterson, who's the Senate President, who already said that he'd like to be the Attorney General. I think there's a belief that folks want a more conservative legislature, a more conservative ticket at the top, and they're basing that on, to a certain extent, the success of Mr. Trump last time around. Now, does that translate out? You know, hard to know. I mean, we've had some special elections in some other states of districts that have been traditionally red where they've elected Democrats. Obviously, we'll hear more from Mr. Culloden this morning about what his ideas are. We know he supports certain things. For example, he was very much against Chris Mays, the Attorney General, when she brought charges against some county officials who refused to certify the election because they were unsure that they had the results. And he wants to say, no, you can't do that. If they're not sure, you can't ask them to certify the election. He also has a few other interesting opinions, not the least of which is going to the firing squad to execute condemned inmates.
Yeah. All right. We'll have to leave it there. Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always.
Have a great day.
Honor Health Research Institute recently opened its new lab called the Center for Translational Science in downtown Phoenix's Bioscience Core. And earlier this year, Honor Health announced the person who'd run that operation, Dr. Sunil Sharma. He's an oncologist who does both clinical and lab-based research. He comes to this job after spending time with TGen, among other firms. Dr. Sharma joins me, and I'd like to start with the timing of all of this. And it seems like a really interesting time for people who do what you do in terms of research, I would imagine, both because of a lot of really interesting new advances, but also maybe some questions about how much of it you're going to be able to continue to do.
The center that we're establishing at Honor Health is actually slightly different from all the basic science and all the important research that is currently under a lot of pressure. Our work is very close to the patients. Mm. So we use, for instance, patients' own tumors to develop models of cancer and then use a sort of sophisticated like genetic and protein information, RNA information to then develop drugs right almost at the bedside. It's not quite at the bedside, obviously, because it's in the lab.
Yeah.
But that's the big promise and excitement of this new effort. But you're absolutely right. Research, sort of the science and research is under a lot of pressure, especially in this last few months.
So are you looking at more maybe personalized medicine? You mentioned maybe taking a patient-specific tumor and creating a treatment for that person that maybe could also be used for other people. But it sounds like what you're doing is very personalized here.
Yeah, I think that there is always the kind of dynamic tension between creating something that can – creating one thing that can apply to everybody and then balancing that against some personalized medicines.
Yeah.
So we actually do both. I'll give you an example of the personalized side of things. Before I just came from TGen where I was now moving my lab, the latest for the last 5 years, we've developed a personalized vaccine and a cell therapy program for patients. In this case, we take the patient's tumor, we sort of do genetic screening on the tumor. We develop, for instance, the best candidates for vaccinating the patient using that genetic information to treat the cancer and use the same genetic information to develop sort of patient's own lymphocytes or cell therapies to treat the cancer. That's been an example of personalized therapy for cancer. Of course, there is a lot of effort also going into developing treatments that are so-called off-the-shelf, where basically the same treatment being given to lots of patients.
Well, what's the balance there? Because I would imagine that, you know, the personalized treatment is great for the person that you created it for. Maybe it has applications for other patients, maybe it doesn't, but that doesn't make it necessarily less expensive and less time consuming to come up with, right?
That's an unbelievably excellent question. That is the problem with the personalized side of things, because in some senses, if you had a treatment which was applicable to everybody, then you could get sort of economies of scale, if you might. On the other hand, a personalized approach is much more sort of individualistic. So you have potentially not just the cost issue, but also the timing issue, meaning you actually need to study the tumor and you need some time to do it and then develop the treatment. So it's not really off the shelf. In certain situations, a singular approach, which is off the shelf, has worked. In fact, most of the cancer drugs that you see, most of the treatments we have are kind of off the shelf. Mm-hmm. And the idea there is, you take the information and you develop treatments that can apply. The big challenge of the personalized treatments is what you just mentioned, is how to do that in an efficient way and reduce the cost.
Well, how similar or different are some of those treatments? Like, is it possible to have sort of, as you described it, like an off-the-shelf treatment that is maybe tweakable depending on a particular patient? Like, is it possible to have sort of the umbrella maybe category of treatments and then maybe make minor modifications based on a specific patient's genetic makeup or the specific kind of tumor they have?
It's a wonderful question again. So as the genetic characterization of the patients has become really advanced, what has happened is there is enormous databases of genetic information for individual patients that are available now. Using methodologies such as artificial intelligence, now we have the ability to do exactly what you're saying, which is look for a base level of shared, potentially actionable information, which would lead to an off-the-shelf product. And then you tweak it or in addition, or give another personalized product in addition to that. And that's exactly the approach we're taking for our vaccines, for instance.
So the new center that that Otter Health is going to be doing, that you're going to be leading, is going to be in very close proximity to other sort of similar facilities, including those from Arizona's public universities. I'm curious to you, what's the benefit? What's the importance of having those other facilities and yours all sort of in the same general place and maybe be able to work together and learn from each other?
Correct. I think we are just in the early phases in Arizona of building a biomedical infrastructure. You know, obviously, as you would know very well, University of Arizona has been here for a long time. Mayo Clinic has been here. What is going on in that quadrangle, if you might, downtown, where ASU is now building the new medical school, which we're partnering with them on? And I think it's a very good time, actually, with all this activity. And now Mayo, I think you might have heard that Mayo just announced their whole Discovery Innovation Center with a large investment up in Scottsdale near where Mayo is. So it's a great time to develop this. And obviously, we need all hands on deck. The big difference with the Center for Translational Science, or the big compliment, I shouldn't say difference, but the thing that we're complementing is that Otter Health is an incredible community-based, healthcare system. I think, like you said, all of this is complementary to the other efforts. There's no, you know, there's some healthy competition, but it's not like we need to all work together, like you said, to make a difference. Yeah.
What do you think is the ultimate potential of all of these different institutions working together, and maybe what is the potential of Phoenix as a biomedical hub? Like, how important could this be nationally, maybe around the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Phoenix is, I think if I'm not wrong on this, is the fifth largest city in the country, robust, with ASU, University of Arizona, NEU, a large, science-based, sort of education system. with all these efforts, I think we really can become the hub for innovation in the biomedical space outside of the coasts. I mean, obviously, right now, everything is sort of very coastal-centric. But I think because of all the people moving here, the population growth, we really, it is sort of incumbent on us to really build this. And we need venture firms and others to co-locate here, some pharmaceutical companies to express interest. But all of that sort of falls into place once you build the different pieces of the puzzle. And if you do, in this case, if you do build, people will come, A, B, discoveries will happen, and then we will, you know, really have an impact both for, you know, the population of Arizona, but beyond that. And that's what, you know, we're committing to here. And obviously, I'm personally committed to it because of all the different things that I mentioned.
Sure. Yeah. All right. That is Dr. Sunil Sharma, director of the Research Institute's new Center for Translational Science at Honor Health. Dr. Sharma, thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a new magazine aims to expand the definition of psychedelic art and literature.
But first, President Trump last week signed an executive order dealing with elections. Among other provisions, it requires voters to show proof of citizenship. Arizona already requires this. The order also looks to stop states from counting ballots that are postmarked by Election Day but don't make it to election officials until after that by withholding funding from states that allow such counting. With me to talk about what this order could mean for Arizona, especially as voters in the 7th Congressional District prepare for a special election this summer to replace the late Raul Grijalva, is Stephen Richer, an opinion contributor at the Arizona Republic and former Maricopa County recorder, and Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor at the Republic. And Stephen, let me start with you. You wrote a piece about this in the paper. So when you look at the executive order on the whole, what's the good? What's the bad?
Well, in terms of good, there's some things that I like as a matter of public policy, such as requiring documented proof of citizenship, such as requiring that people get their mail ballots back by Election Day. But the broader point that I hope to make in the article is that this is just highly unorthodox in terms of how it's done. Doing it at the federal level and doing it through executive order. Election administration is usually left to the states, and to the extent that the federal government gets involved, Congress usually writes those laws.
Yeah, Elvie, it's one of those areas of government. You hear, you know, a few others, education, especially right now, being one that, you know, one of those areas that, yes, impacts the federal government, but is not typically overseen, or, you know, the rules and laws created are not necessarily by the federal government. It's usually left to the states or in some cases localities.
Yes, absolutely. And as Stephen was saying, we are focused more on the proof of citizenship and forgetting about the other parts of the executive order. I'll be the first one to admit that I certainly don't understand the whole executive order. For example, you know, it says that the U.S. Election Assistant Commission must clamp down on tabulators, which are, you know, Stephen obviously knows more about this, but to me, that's essentially, you know, rewriting the rules of elections at the federal level, which again, that's the job of Congress, not the president of the United States. And, you know, it tells me that the president and Republicans for a long time has been focused on making it a lot more difficult for people to vote instead of incentivizing those who usually don't vote to actually cast a ballot and participate in our democratic society.
Stephen, as you point out in your piece, Arizona has a proof of citizenship law and has for a number of years. And it's kind of created this almost bifurcated system where some folks are only allowed to vote in federal elections, you know, for Congress or Senate or the president. They're not allowed to vote in other elections down the ballot. What kind of impact might this executive order have on those voters, especially since there's an election coming up in just a few months?
That's right. We have a special election that's coming up that's a federal election, and that's to replace U.S. House member Grijalva, who recently died. The point I was trying to make, and it's a bit convoluted, is that Arizona has long sought to require documented proof of citizenship for all elections, for all contests. We were told by the United States Supreme Court previously, however, that we could not impose that requirement on people voting in federal contests, so U.S. House, U.S. Senate, and President of the United States. And that's because our laws were preempted by the NVRA, the National Voter Registration Act, created by Congress. And so we have this split system. But now my point is, well, if the NVRA is done away with by President Trump's executive order, then does Arizona's law kick in where everyone has to have documented proof of citizenship? And so therefore, would these federal-only voters, these 30, 40,000 some voters in Arizona, no longer be eligible to vote in any contest, not just not eligible to vote in state and local contests, but they wouldn't be able to vote at all?
Now, Stephen, of the three of us, you're the one who's actually an attorney. Can an executive order overturn a law like that?
This is, like I said, I think unorthodox is the polite way of putting it. But normally, the president cannot undo federal law that has been drafted by Congress and signed in by a previous president. The president cannot undo that through executive order. And then there's also an issue with Article 1, Section 4 of the United States Constitution says the time, place, and manner will be left to the states to determine how they want to administer elections. And so I think you're going to see this attacked in the courts on two different fronts. And I'm a little surprised that we haven't already had a lawsuit filed, but I suspect that will be happening soon.
So, Elvia, the word that keeps coming to mind as I'm listening to Stephen talk is uncertainty. That, you know, we saw this actually in the last election with the glitch at MVD that led some voters to not be sure leading up to Election Day whether or not they'd be able to vote. What does uncertainty do for elections, especially in a special election, which will probably already be lower turnout than what we might see in a regular election?
Well, it creates distrust, and I think that's the objective here. And we have seen that since 2020. The president and MAGA movement has done nothing but lie about stealing elections and voter fraud. And so this adds to that uncertainty and the chaos. And again, the technicalities of this executive order worries me the most. If we get rid of the tabulators, for instance, which is, you know, the equipment that helps expedite the vote count. So well, what is that going to do? So it adds a lot of uncertainty, a lot of doubt. And in the end, I go back to the same issue. You know, creating distrust means that fewer people might be voting. And I think that's the objective, to make sure that people do not participate in voting. I mean, in principle, for instance, you know, requiring people to prove that they are, in fact, U.S. citizens to vote, it's a good thing, right? I mean, who's going to disagree on principle on something like that? But it's all the other steps that needs to be taken to fulfill that worries me the most.
Well, so, Stephen, what do you think that this means for example, the Pima County Recorder and other election officials in that part of the state who are going to be dealing with this coming up for this summer special election?
So technically, this is federal law as of today. Now, what I think will happen is a number of public interest groups will sue. I think that they'll ask the federal courts for a temporary restraining order, meaning that certain parts of the law won't go into effect until the constitutionality or the legality of those parts has been determined. And that could put it in a freeze position. But I think that right now there's probably a lot of uncertainty. And I assume that all 15 county recorders are asking their county attorneys to weigh in on this, to tell them what to do. And simply put, I'll say what I said at the end of the article, which is, all told, this is one of those weeks when I'm happy that I'm no longer Maricopa County Recorder.
Well, so, I mean, like, what put yourself back in that spot for just a minute? I won't make you do it for too much longer than that. But, like, how do you try to plan for an election? How do you reach out to voters? What do you say to voters, especially those federal-only voters, when you're not really sure what the deal is for them at this point?
I don't know. Simply put, I think that I would probably end up being a holding pattern, but we would also put out some social media. We might look into doing letters to all the federal-only voters. Now, the good thing about the federal-only list is if you are placed on the federal-only list, you are required to get a letter upon registration from your county recorder. So none of those people should be unaware that they are on the federal-only list. Again, what we don't know yet is if those people will be able to continue voting federal-only, or if Arizona's law from 2004 will kick into effect, which requires documented proof of citizenship.
Sure. All right. We'll have to leave it there. That is Stephen Richer, opinion contributor with the Arizona Republic, of course, former Maricopa County recorder as well. Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor at the Arizona Republic. Elvia, Stephen, thank you both so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Always a pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Tensions in the ongoing war between Russia and Ukraine continued to flare over the weekend. Joining me now via Skype with the latest, along with other developments around the world, is the BBC's Pete Ross. Pete, let's begin in Ukraine, as the Trump administration continues to push for a swift ceasefire deal, despite both sides continuing their attacks on each other. What is the latest?
Yeah, let's begin there, Sam, with both sides over the weekend accusing each other of continuing their military campaign. On the one side, Ukraine over the weekend accused Russia of committing a war crime after a drone strike on a military hospital in the eastern city of Kharkiv. The Ukrainian army said some of the casualties were servicemen being treated at the hospital, and they called that, therefore, a deliberate act, and they'd be notifying the International Criminal Court. President Zelensky backed those comments up by saying that Russia was using drone strikes to undermine peace talks, and he expected a strong and serious response from Europe and the US. Meanwhile, for Russian side, the Russian Defense Ministry said this morning that Ukraine had continued its attacks on Russian territories. It said that it had shot down 66 Ukrainian drones from Sunday into Monday. So the military campaigns are very much still continuing, as we'd expect, sadly. A couple of things to look out for this week. Two big meetings just to draw your attention to quickly. In Europe, we have EU defence ministers meeting on Wednesday and Thursday in Poland. They're going to be discussing an extensive military aid package for Ukraine, recently proposed by the EU, by the Foreign Affairs Representative Kaja Kallas. It's a huge package of measures, and European defence ministers will be discussing that on Wednesday and Thursday. Another meeting taking place this week to look out for, it's the NATO Foreign Ministers meeting. That takes place Thursday, Friday in Brussels. It's chaired by the Secretary General, Mark Rutte. And of course, Ukraine and further military aid for Ukraine very much likely to dominate proceedings.
Well, Pete, let's move to Turkey next, where demonstrations have been growing since the arrest of President Erdogan's main political rival on corruption charges almost 2 weeks ago. Hundreds of people have been detained since protests erupted following the arrest of Istanbul's mayor, yet his supporters continue to march. Can we expect more protests this week?
Yes, I think we can. Now, just to go back a little bit before we go forward, you'll know that demonstrations began earlier this month. They began in the capital of Turkey, Istanbul, on the 19th of March. They were sparked by the arrest of the leading opposition politician, that's Ekrem İmamoğlu. He's the mayor of Istanbul, a very popular mayor. I believe he's in a third term now. And his arrest came just days before the Republican People's Party of Turkey, known as the CHP, were set to elect him as their presidential candidate. And many political observers thought that he would have a very strong chance in defeating Turkey's current president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, at the next general election, which is not for a couple of years. But Erdogan's been in power for more than 20 years now. And it was thought that İmamoğlu was the only Turkish politician capable of challenging Erdogan. However, he was arrested, and a series of mass pro-democracy protests broke out in Istanbul. And this sort of protest is usually cracked down pretty quickly. In fact, when these protests first broke out, the authorities tried to ban them and told people to stay off the streets. However, that has not happened. And the protests have now grown and they've spread from Istanbul to other places around the country as well. So what we have at the moment is a bit of a standoff. The protests show no sign of abating at the moment. That's despite, a real crackdown by the government there. So one to watch out for this week. Will these protests continue to grow and will they continue to gather support in other parts of the country? I think that's the real crucial point here.
All right. Well, let's move finally, Pete, to a part of the world that I think American listeners are paying closer attention to these days than we are accustomed. Denmark's Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen will visit Greenland later this week, and that comes after Donald Trump's repeated claims that he wants to take over control of the Arctic island from Denmark, and it follows a visit from U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance. What can we expect here?
Well, you said it yourself there, Sam. I mean, Greenland, perhaps a part of the world that U.S. listeners, people in the U.S. are a little bit more familiar with. And, you know, I think when this was first brought up, it was on the campaign trail, wasn't it? Donald Trump mentioned something as he was running for the White House again about Greenland and how it would be good for perhaps Washington to take control of Greenland. Now, at the time, I think a lot of people looked upon it as just something that Donald Trump said to get a reaction and it would perhaps, you know, kind of disappear. Well, last week you had the vice president, J.D. Vance, went there and he visited the American air base, at which point he made some fairly pointed comments about Denmark and Denmark's commitments to Greenland, which, by the way, is an autonomous territory. I believe Vance said, in fact, that Denmark was neglecting the territory. Now, on Saturday, Danish officials pushed back against those claims, saying that America had neglected Greenland security by significantly scaling back its military presence in the Arctic. Denmark, at the beginning of this year, pledged billions of euros to step up its military presence in the Arctic. So what we have at the moment is a bit of a tit for tat, a bit of a J.D. Vance visits. Now we have Denmark's Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen saying that she's going to be visiting Greenland later this week. She'll be there for longer than J.D. Vance. And of course, she'll be there to strengthen those traditional ties that Denmark has with Greenland. And, you know, the ball is now back in your court, America. So we'll have to see what, you know, Donald Trump does with that ball, I guess.
All right. Well, some brinksmanship in amongst familiar sparring partners and some not so familiar sparring partners.
Indeed.
That is the BBC's Pete Ross. Pete, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Sam. Always a pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Question for all of you. What do you think about when you hear the phrase psychedelic art? If your first association is pulsating mandalas, day-glow school buses, and legions of hippies dropping out of college to follow the Grateful Dead around the country, think again. Since its heyday in the 1960s, psychedelic art has often been written off as either eccentric or frivolous, a relic of the Vietnam era that doesn't resonate so much anymore. But a new magazine wants to change that perception. Elastic is a new print magazine that looks to move past the so-called first era of psychedelia and define a new, more relevant era of art that permeates traditional boundaries and definitions of visual art and literature. The first issue of Elastic is available now, and I recently spoke to senior editor Mira Sharma and editor-in-chief Hilary Brenhaus.
The studies that are coming out about these substances and, PTSD, postpartum depression, all kinds of mental health issues are really encouraging. And at the same time, this like entire realm of art and culture has sort of been neglected.
Yeah. Well, do you think psychedelia has lost its countercultural juice with this shift in the cultural conversation towards psychedelics as a modality for like mental health and wellness?
Yeah. I mean, I think psychedelic art still has this political component that might not be apparent when you first consider it, but if you look at writing, for example, that plays with time, it's like, why might you decide to not use like an easy linear narrative structure when you're writing? It could be to challenge like Western colonial story structures. It could be to capture alternate histories that have been like very deliberately overlooked, or to conjure other worlds.
Yeah, that's interesting. Psychedelics as a way of not just taking on political power structures, but political story structures, perhaps. Mira,
yeah,
what about you? Do you feel like we are in a different psychedelic era than what has come before when it comes to art?
You know, the term is sometimes applied loosely to writing and art, but what we're trying to do with Elastic is kind of curate and define, okay, what does this mean for now? And, you know, why is it useful to talk about things in this language? And I think, you know, the first psychedelic era was obviously a time of radical social change. And I think we're similarly in a moment of rupture and transformation. There's kind of an outpouring and a hunger as well for art that feels mind expanding and feels like it offers new ways of seeing the world, new ways of talking about the world.
This seems just like a perfect moment for something like speculative nonfiction. There's a reason why there seems to be a need in the literary community for that kind of form or non-form.
I have to ask you more about the phrase speculative nonfiction, because it's very trippy in its own right. Can you give me an example of what speculative nonfiction might be? Would it be like a memoir infused with dream logic, or what might we be talking about there?
Yeah, I think absolutely it might be a memoir infused with dream logic. It might be a piece that deals with climate change, for example, 3/4 of which is like rooted in our present, and then suddenly skips forward to, you know, 200 years into our future and paints some kind of grim picture, or, you know, brings us to some future that, you know, just hasn't arrived yet.
Wow.
I think
it could also be a piece of writing where, you know, the facts are facts, but the orientation is fantastical or impossible. So for instance, you know, a cultural history of a landscape from the perspective of a mushroom. or a sort of piece of reportage from the perspective of a miscarriage. Thinking, you know, how do we talk about reality but put ourselves in positions that help us see what's right in front of us in totally new ways?
So far in our conversation, we have been talking about looking towards the future frontiers of what might be. But I don't want to move past the fact that there is, in one very important sense, a backward-looking element of Elastic's mission, which is to acknowledge artists of color from that first psychedelic era that perhaps haven't gotten their due. So tell me a little bit about who some of those artists are.
I'm thinking of, for instance, like Sam Gilliam, who was part of what was known as the Washington Color School, and whose work was overlooked for a very long time until well up into his 80s. He was making they were called drape paintings. So you have these sort of paintings that are no longer in canvases, these really massive, abstract canvases that were sort of like draped and hung in the middle of a room or sort of across a wall, this combination of scale and mystery, like because it's draped, there are parts of the canvas that you can't see. And so you have this like massive work that's sort of mysterious in the way that it hangs. And I think that is really bound up with the idea of psychedelic art.
And I think what's interesting is the idea of putting some of these more overlooked artists of the 60s and 70s in conversation with contemporary artists whose work is sort of distinctly of that tradition. So, you know, I think of somebody like Tomashi Jackson, who makes these kind of mixed media paintings that are full of kind of vivid, colorful, geometric textiles, but sort of hidden within these like very constructed, visceral works are black and white stills of news footage of protests, police brutality. So you have this kind of atmospheric, kind of mysterious experience encountering the work, but then the sort of more you look at it, the more you sort of see this reality kind of flickering through. And I think somebody like Tomasi is really in conversation with artists of the first psychedelic era.
Well, as a last question, to whatever extent you're both comfortable with it, I'm curious to know if psychedelics have played any role in your own artistic practices and how much that informs your work on Elastic.
I can say yes. Psychedelic substances and the role they played in my life have encouraged me to think more expansively about my work, to think about multi-genre collaborations.
Mira, what about for you?
I think for me, my relationship to psychedelics and psychedelia is a bit more oblique and possibly more sort of conceptual. I mean, I think what really appealed to me about Hillary's framing of this project was the kind of broadening of this term and thinking about this term as an orientation, as a sensibility. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my own work, I've always been really interested in dreams and have used dreams and sort of the dreaming, sleeping experience as like a generative space. So like the novel that I'm working on sort of arrived in my mind during a period of insomnia over the course of many sleepless nights. And I think that there is something about the sort of dream space that connects to the sort of experience of being on psychedelics, that seam between kind of the material world and the dream world feels very rich for me.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Mira Sharma, senior editor, and Hillary Brenhouse, editor-in-chief of Elastic, a magazine of psychedelic art, thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us.
The mall was a big part of Eric Pearson's life as a kid.
The mall was just a place that we went to as kids because it was free air conditioning, it was stuff to do, it was somewhere our parents could get rid of us, you know, for a little bit. So I spent a lot of time, especially my teenage years, at the mall. And then just watching over the years as a lot of the malls in the Phoenix area kind of started to slowly crumble, it just became super interesting to me that something that when I was a teenager was so popular and so busy is now something that a lot of people don't even think about anymore.
Pearson grew up in Phoenix. He's now in his 40s, and malls are still a part of his life. He runs the Retail Archaeology channel on YouTube, where, among other things, he takes viewers inside dead and dying malls. I met Pearson recently in the food court of a Valley Mall to talk about his interest in these places.
The first time that I ever visited what you would call a dead mall was Fiesta Mall, right before I started my YouTube channel, probably about 7 years ago. And that was the first mall that I went into and ever saw it be dead. Like, not hardly any businesses open, no people walking around. And it was just so impactful, that experience, that it got me interested into it.
Was there a time period that to you sort of led to or was sort of emblematic of the downfall of the mall in the Phoenix area?
Yeah, I think starting in about the late 90s, now in the late 90s, I wouldn't say malls were dying in the Phoenix area, but in the late 90s is when we kind of got all of the malls in the Phoenix area built. And I think that was kind of the beginning of the end for a lot of them, because I feel like malls were overbuilt in the Phoenix area. And so you had malls competing with malls, and there just was too many malls for the amount of people in the Phoenix area. And so I think that's kind of when it started, but I don't think it became something that a lot of people noticed until probably the early to mid 2000s is when it really started, I think, becoming apparent to a lot of other people.
What role do you think things like Amazon and like Target and Walmart and sort of the big box stores, what role did they play in sort of the demise, in addition to, as you say, maybe too many malls for not enough people here?
I think it's interesting how a lot of people will say Amazon killed the mall, the internet killed the mall. I think it's interesting that you kind of lumped Target and Walmart in there, because I think that's the bigger picture. Obviously, Amazon is not good for malls, but retailers like Target and Walmart have really exploded as well. And they also sell a lot of things that malls sell. So I think the internet, Target, Walmart, overbuilding, economic conditions. It's all kind of like a death by a thousand cuts kind of thing.
So you mentioned how people, you know, shopping is a little different now, our habits, you know, people want to walk to a store and not have to walk around an entire mall. I'm curious what you think about other reasons to bring people to the mall. I mean, there's a train that just pulled up behind where we're sitting. There's an arcade right there. Like, you can come to a mall now and not actually do any shopping.
Yeah, and I think that's a change that is important for malls to make. Like, I think this mall, Arizona Mills Mall, does a good job offering a lot of experiences. Like the Tilt Arcade behind us, you've got a Legoland experience here. I think the malls that do a good job of kind of mixing those experiences in with the retail stuff, I think do a better job of getting people into the mall.
I know that you've walked through, you mentioned Fiesta Mall, I know Metro Center was a big place for you in your childhood. When you walk through those dead malls, like, what do you see through your eyes? Like, what does it look like? What does it feel like to you walking through those places?
It's a mix of feelings. There's a very large feeling of nostalgia. Just kind of walking around and remembering how things were when I was younger. There's also kind of a sense of melancholy. Because these buildings are so big, when you walk around them, you start to get the sense that, you know, is it really like just this mall that has a problem, or is this a sign of bigger things, you know, for the economy or whatever in general? So it's a mix of feeling, wonderment, and just that kind of watching a car crash feeling, because that's kind of what it's like. You're watching kind of a slow motion car crash, basically, as things kind of start to fall apart and close down. And so it's hard to explain, but it's a mix of good memories and worrying about the future, I guess.
What worries you about the future when you look at malls closing down or not doing well?
You know, there's obviously the economic worries. You know, is this happening because of issues with the economy? I worry about, you know, when I was a teenager, the mall was a place to go socialize, maybe get a job and learn how to kind of have that first job experience and learn how to have a job. And with the malls going away, you know, when a mall goes away, a lot of that is lost. It's not just like, oh, I can't go to Sears and go buy something. It's, you know, all the teenagers in this area have lost a place to experience those kind of important first steps of life, like getting a job, you know, meeting a girl at the mall, that kind of stuff. You know, it's just all kind of, I worry that that's all going to go away. And it worries me that, you know, people in general don't socialize as much as they used to. And so having one less place to go do that feels bad.
So growing up in a place like Phoenix, I would imagine that you have seen a lot of things change over the course of your life so far. When you look at a thing like Metro Center or malls in general, like, where does that fit for you in sort of the oh my gosh, this is very different than the place of my childhood?
It's kind of, it's sad in a way, because again, you know, malls back when I was a kid, they were exciting places. They were bustling. When you were there, when you were in the mall, you know, you could socialize, and it just kind of seemed like a kind of perfect slice of America, Americana. But now that's kind of slowly going away, and it kind of losing things, you know, not just like malls, but the retail setting in general has kind of started to become so bland and everything that it's just, I don't know if depressing is the word, but it's sad to see some of the changes and to see some of the vibrancy and whatnot kind of removed from the community.
So when you post a video about a mall or a dead mall, like, what kind of comments do you get? What kind of responses do viewers give you based on that?
There's several different kinds. A lot of them, and the ones that I enjoy the most, are the ones of people who grew up going to that mall. Like, I get a lot of comments on videos, like when I did one on Metro Center, from people saying, oh, you know, I live in Nebraska now, but I grew up in Phoenix, and I remember going to Metro Center Mall, and I haven't seen it in 30 years. And so a lot of times it's thanking me for putting that up for them to see, so they can kind of, because they'll start to, oh, that's where I, you know, met this girl, or that this is where I got this video game, you know, and over in that corner where that store used to be. So there's a lot of that, a lot of nostalgia. There is a lot of, you know, that's Amazon for you. Amazon killed them all. And, you know, I try to reply to as many of those as possible, you know, at least explaining my point of view that, although Amazon hasn't been good for malls, I don't think it's the thing that killed it on its own. But most of the comments are people just kind of reminiscing about the place that I filmed and sharing stories about things that happened when they were there in the past.
Eric Pearson runs the Retail Archaeology YouTube channel. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.